What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Black Girl Gone Afterthoughts. I, of course, am your host, Amara, and I am here with my husband and my co-host, Jason.
What's going on, y'all?
So, you may have noticed we've been gone for a few weeks. So, you know, nothing was going on. We just took a break, like, as they say, life be lifin'. And, you know, the kids is home this summer. And, you know, so we just took a little break from Afterthoughts. But we are back. I know some of you have been asking in the comments, like, what happened to Afterthoughts? We miss Afterthoughts. I hope you guys are still doing it. So, you know, we are back, you know, after a little brief hiatus.
You know? Yeah. So, you know, definitely a long summer.
Yeah.
And now that the kids are back in school, we wanted to start to bring some more Afterthoughts. And as we go forward, Afterthoughts are going to be, you know, just kind of based upon, you know, you guys and, you know, your response and questions that you have and your interest in the stories. That, you know, that was the initial reason for Afterthoughts, Amara's thoughts plus Black Girl Gone listener thoughts. So I read somebody said that they made a comment. It was like, well, I don't, you know, I don't quite understand Afterthoughts, which we, you know, kind of talked about.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons for Afterthoughts. So if you're new to Afterthoughts and have started listening to Black Girl Gone in the last 2 months or, you know, just came aboard, you know, it's really just a chance to understand Amara's perspective. Some things from the story that might not have been placed in the actual story and the actual case that Amara puts together and comes out on Mondays. And a lot of times you're going to get just like how, you know, we relate to the story as people, how sometimes Amara relates to the story and can understand, you know, what some of the things, you know, being young, dating, you know, being in having a family, just struggles that we all kind of go through and how we can create a community around that and, you know, make this message of what the stories are just a little bit bigger. And that's really the thought. That's really the purpose of Afterthoughts. Some of these stories that we tell are in, you know, kind of unique cities. Some of them are cities that we live in, and a lot of it is different from some of the stories you might hear if it's in a, you know, very, very small town or a very, very rural town where it's not like, you know, growing up in the city. And Amara and I have spent most of our life in the city. So, you know, sometimes you get a different perspective on some cases if you've grown up in the city. So, you know, we're happy to be back. And as always, we're going to get right into this week's case that Amara covered. This is the story of the Harper family, yeah, which is something that Amara decided to do a little bit different. But the focus is mainly on Joni Harper. Amara, give us a recap of that story.
Yeah, so like you said, this week we did something different in terms of the type of story or the, I guess you should say, the number of victims in the story because I've never done a story that involves a family like this. So, you know, the mom, the wife, the children, that's never been done. I've never done a story like that. So this was something very different for, you know, us and for you guys as the audience to hear from Black Girl Gone. Now, some of you may have heard this story before. I know it's been on Dateline and it's been on a couple of other true crime shows, but I actually had never heard of the story, which is interesting because it does seem like a story that was very popular, especially at the time and especially considering the circumstances. But I just wasn't familiar with it. So just to, you know, refamiliarize you with this story, just to remind you. So this week we did a story about the Harper family, Joni Harper, who was 39 years old, her mother, Ernestine Harper, who was 70 years old, and then Joni's three children, 4-year-old Marcus, 23-month-old Lindsay, and then 6-week-old Marshall, who were all found shot to death inside of their home in Bakersfield, California. Their bodies were found on July 8th, but police investigators' autopsy revealed that the murders had actually taken place on July 6th. Joni was a staple in her community. So was her mother. Her mother was an activist, had, you know, ran an organization. But Joni was married to a man named Vincent Beverly. Now, Vincent himself had a, you know, really good reputation in the community. He was a principal, well-known, well-liked. But him and Joni had issues in their relationship. They got married, got divorced, got remarried, had three children. And eventually they ended up separating again after their second marriage. And then on July the 6th, Joni goes to church with her children and her mother, and then no one hears from them again. Her friend ends up finding their bodies inside the home. Vincent is almost immediately a suspect because of the circumstances, because he is the spouse. But he has an alibi that he was in Ohio at the time of the murders. He flew out to see his brother. That was what he told police. An investigation goes on for about a year. And then eventually police arrest Vincent. And the evidence that they have against him is that the credit cards that he had used as his part of his alibi when he was in Ohio, they found out his brother had used them. They had determined that he had rented a car and put over 5,000 miles on the vehicle in a very short period of time. And because of that, they decided that, you know, they were able to conclude, I should say, that he had driven the car from Ohio to California, killed his family, and then driven back, and that his trip to Ohio was basically a cover-up for the murders and was an attempt to create an alibi. Vincent is eventually arrested, and he is tried for the murder of his family, and he is ultimately convicted and sentenced to death and is currently sitting on death row in San Quentin. So that's the recap of the story.
Yeah, I mean, you know what we do when we do afterthoughts, we do some interesting things. And one thing that I just want to go into before I give you your the floor to go ahead and tell the interesting things that you feel came up in this case is that he remarried her.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, man. I hate to compare. I always hate to compare, you know, people's situations, and you know, people get remarried. Like, it's, you know, they're not the first couple to get remarried.
Yeah.
But I feel like
it's strange.
Because whatever he might have been going through, whether it was you know he really didn't want to settle down, mm-hmm. or you know, he just had a lot of lust in his heart or whatever, yeah. you know, whatever was going on. He was free from that. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like the first time around, he was free from that. And then he put himself in the situation where he kind of recommitted to something that he didn't even want.
Yeah.
And that is, to me, unless, you know, the story doesn't really talk about any real, like, situations they had, or I'm pretty sure they had arguments, you know, about his infidelity and things mm-hmm. of that nature. But besides that, like, you know, if you didn't really want that, you were in a situation yeah. you were in a clear, man.
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense. I think it's in terms of outside of obviously the murders and what he did to his family when he was convicted of doing to his family. Outside of that, it is one of the strangest parts of the story. It's one of the most hardest parts of the story to understand. It's like you said, he was free. He could have just not remarried her. I mean, they did have the children together, so he would have always been tied to her through the children. So if you consider
but you know, that's not really enough for
be for somebody. I'm saying?
I understand it.
And even if his desire was to not have to pay child support, you know, I mean, a lot of time, you know, men who are in this situation you know, when a man has killed his entire family, you know, the term is a family annihilator, because you've annihilated your entire family. You kill your wife, your children. And the thing about it is that's never, because in every one of those circumstances, you could have just left. You could have just left her. You didn't want to be with her. You found somebody new. You could have just left. You didn't have to kill her, and you definitely didn't have to kill the children. But for whatever reason, it's like they have to sever this entire part of their lives. They don't want to have any connection to this part of their lives. And I think that when it comes to Vincent Brothers, like, when you look at the things that he is was accused of, and the things that he was ultimately convicted for doing, it reigns like sociopath, you know what I mean? Because he had this whole different persona where he's this teacher and he's this mentor and everybody loves him and he's this great guy, you know, but he's not showing up as that person in his marriage. And then, you know, a month after they first get married, their marriage is annulled because he's disappearing and refusing to tell his wife where he is. They stay they stay connected, you know. That I can't say that was him, all him, because from the description that Joni's brother gives is that she was in love with Vincent. He was the love of her life. She had children with him. By the time they got remarried, she was pregnant with her third child by this man. You know what I mean? So she wanted to be with him. If Vincent, you know, has those sociopathic tendencies, then yeah, he's manipulating, controlling, you know, all of that is a part of it. But that didn't necessarily meant that he really necessarily wanted to be with Joni. I that's just my kind of take on it, you know, because that's the only thing that makes sense in terms of why he would remarry her. Now, it's also, when you kind of think about it, it kind of doesn't matter, because he could have killed her anyway, married or not. They weren't even living together.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? No. So whatever his plot was or his plan was, maybe when he remarried her in January 2003, he didn't want to kill her and the children. But this didn't happen until July of 2003. We're talking about almost 7 months after they first got married. Who knows what transpired in their relationship? Who knows what transpired in his mind that then drove him, even in that very, what seems like a very short period of time, to make this type of decision? So,
and I mean, at the end of the day, even with that explanation, that time frame,
it's crazy.
It's really weird.
It's really
weird. Like 10 years.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know exactly when they met, because I couldn't find that information.
I mean, like, what I meant by 10 years is like if it would have happened. Like,
oh, you know, no, I know what you mean. No, okay. I know. I got what you're saying. I'm just saying I don't know exactly when they met. Right. So, all we know is that the son was born. Their first child was born in 1998. So they met sometime before that.
Okay.
Either, you know, even if it was briefly before that, they met before she got pregnant, right? So sometime before 1998, she meets him. They get married in 2000. So we're talking 2 years later, they get married. But a month after that, their marriage is annulled. And then I believe that same year, their second child is born, even after this annulment. Then they reconcile, but then they are back to they're separated again, but then they had their third child. So, you know, without having, obviously, knowing exactly what was going on in their relationship, it's really hard to say or hard to understand what was going on. But there was something going on that was drawing Joni back to him, you know what I mean? Like, and, you know, her brother says that he never heard his sister say anything about Vincent being violent or anything like that, you know. So there were things that were going on, and that's not to say that he wasn't, that she might just not have told her brother, you know what I mean? Because what I've seen, especially from doing this for so long, in these, a lot of these cases, this could be happening to her and she's not telling her brother what's going on, you know what I mean? So just because he didn't know doesn't mean that it wasn't happening. And even if it wasn't physical abuse. It very well could have been verbal abuse. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Okay. So, we're going to go to some of your interesting things, just a few, because we know most of the things about this case. Before that, like I said, we're going to do afterthoughts a little bit out of order today, just because we're back. A comment on YouTube says his brother needs to be prosecuted, too, for trying to cover up his evilness.
Yeah. I don't know whatever happened to the brother. I don't know if he, struck a deal because he ended up testifying. I have no idea, but he definitely, he was, helping his brother. I mean, a lot of people would have, done that for their brother.
We've had cases. We've had other cases like this where,
Yeah, but I'm not sure what type of, deal he struck or what the police ultimately concluded about him, even though he had lied. He did ultimately end up telling the truth, but I don't know. Yeah, he definitely played a role in this for sure.
Okay, let's go right into it. Give me first interesting or shocking, as we like to use.
Yeah.
About this case. Go for it.
So, one of the things that stood out for me, was the fact that Vincent Beverly was a educator. You know what I mean? I think that was the part of this story that it's like, there's so many layers to this story that make it so almost unbelievable, you know what I mean? Because of the crime in and of itself. But then when you like really look deeper into it, even every part of this is just unbelievable. And one of those parts for me is the fact that Vincent Beverly was a teacher. So he wasn't somebody with a criminal history. He wasn't somebody, I mean, he did have these domestic violence incident when he was married to his first wife and had spent six days in jail. So he did have that. But, I'm talking about, like, he didn't have this extensive criminal history.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? He wasn't, known as a bad person or a bad guy. He was really beloved in his community. People knew him. They loved him. He was well-educated. He had a master's degree in education. He was on paper, everything that you would want in a husband, he was, like I said, he was he was the type of a black male teacher that, first of all, is rare. But he wasn't a teacher, an educator. That is rare, because one of the things that, people always talk about is the need for black men to be teachers. We need more black men teachers. We need more black men in education, because it's important for, little black boys, little black girls to see people that look like them. It's important, especially for little black boys, to be in schools where they can have a black male teacher. That can make a big difference in a little, black boy's life.
Yeah.
And so to have one of those people be Vincent Beverly, who, like I said, who well-respected. Everybody knew him in this community. He was, somebody actually on YouTube commented and said that he was her elementary school principal. Like, people knew this man. He wasn't.
And once again, this is the reason for afterthoughts, is because, people can relate to this, like, firsthand.
So easily, because it's, and because the story didn't take place, 50 years ago. It took place in 2003. So, it wasn't that long ago, but back to Vincent. But so, like I said, he's this well-respected educator, administrator, principal, and he is then arrested and accused and ultimately convicted for the murder of his family. And we're talking his wife, estranged or not, his wife, and his three children, which, of course, to anybody is like, how? How could someone murder a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old and a 6-week-old baby.
Yeah.
Like, what would the 6-week-old baby have done? How could you, you know, and just, like, the evil that it would even take to do something like that, to that type of innocence. The fact that those two people are the same people. And that's why I even said before when you were saying about him remarrying her, it's like, it's these, like, sociopathic tendencies where it's like he can be the he can be whoever he needs to be for whoever he needs to be that for. At school, he's this upstanding, well-respected, you know, principal, and everybody loves him. But at home, you know, he's cheating on his wife. He has this unstable relationship with her, and then ultimately he does the unimaginable by murdering her, her mother, and his 3 children. It's, like I said, him being a teacher definitely, or an educator, is definitely it's crazy. It's a crazy part of the story. It's a very crazy part of the story. It's not something that you, and like I said, teachers are people, so let's not act like, you know, they're not people, and people are capable of doing anything. But like I said, in this circumstance, you know, and it's also sad because of who he was supposed to be, the representation of a Black male educator, you know, who he was supposed to be. That's the image who he's supposed to be. Now the image of him is Vincent Brothers, family annihilator, man who killed a 6-week-old baby, his own 6-week-old. That's the image of him, you know, so.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the more interesting parts of this case. Let's get to something else that you have interesting about this case.
Okay, so I'm just going to skip right to after Vincent is arrested, because we know that, you know, he is arrested for murdering his family, but he has this alibi that he was in Ohio. And the thing that's so interesting about this case is how the detectives, investigators, and the prosecution were really able to piece together this evidence. Because like I say in the episode, like, it was very circumstantial. There, as far as I could tell, there wasn't any that I, like I said, saw publicly any, like, direct evidence. Like, they found, you know, his fingerprints being inside the house would not have been something, because he...
Right. He was living there.
Yeah, he was living there. It was his family.
It was his crib, yeah.
You know, they never found the knife that was used to stab Joni, in addition to the gun, because she was shot and she was stabbed. They never found the knife. I didn't see anything about whether or not they found the gun either. So they didn't have this, like, direct hardcore, like, smoking gun, as, you know, as they say, evidence against him. But what they were able to build was this case based on these, like, series of events, like the timeline of his travel, the odometer reading, the bugs on the radiator, right? So the first thing that is interesting about the evidence is the fact that, like, yes, we know that he said that he was in Ohio, and the first way that the police are able to corroborate or try to corroborate his story is by looking at his credit card statements. And his credit card statements say that he was at stores that were in Columbus, Ohio. And so at first, it's like, oh, okay, cool. But detectives were very much focused on Vincent Beverly, which I also thought was very interesting because of who he was in this community. And after all, he was a Black man, so, you know, aside from being a school principal, you know what I mean? But they were very much focused on him. And he was also, obviously, the spouse. So in these sorts of cases, he is the most likely suspect. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why police would have focused on him. But I thought that the fact that he was this educator, I think it was the way that they kind of immediately honed in on him. You know what I mean? It wasn't, it's like they didn't even give him, like, a chance. Like, they knew almost immediately that it was him. And then they spent a year basically building that case. But back to the evidence. So he says he's in Ohio. they use the credit card statements to prove that or to try to prove that. And at first they think it's cool, but then they find they pull the surveillance footage from the stores that match the credit card statements. And when they look at the timestamp of the credit cards, the purchase and the surveillance, the person that's making that purchase is not Vincent Beverly, it's his brother. And so now they know that, okay, something's going on. They bring the brother in. At first the brother says, you know, he lies. But then eventually he admits that his brother Vincent gave him the cards. So that's the first part of the evidence that they're using, that they're tracking, right? And then they go from that to the odometer reading on the vehicle, which I also thought was very, very interesting, because I wonder, and obviously this is not like something that was in like the news articles, but I wonder what drew police to, or the detectives to check the odometer reading. Like, what made them think like, oh, he drove from Ohio? Because that is a stretch. You know what I mean? Like, that's not something like anybody would just do.
Nah.
From drive from Ohio to California and back. Like,
you gotta be committed.
Yeah, that's a big, that's a huge commitment. And so it's interesting to me what made them like figure that out. Like, I wonder what, but like, was like, well, let's check the odometer reading on the car. And that's how they, you know, so they see that. And through that, they're able to tell that the amount of miles driven on the car and the period of time in which he had the car was just way too much for him just, you know, driving around the area around his brother's house. And so through that, they conclude that he drove back to California, killed his family, and then drove back to Ohio to, you know, have this alibi. So those are all, to me, very interesting things, because like I said, they're not just relying or looking for, you know, hair or blood or DNA, you know what I mean? They're really like, the way they dug deep into this investigation and were able to uncover all of these things that had they not found out, Vincent would not have gotten arrested. Like, had it not been for how these things really played out, he wouldn't have gotten caught, because they didn't have, even with their suspicion and all of that, they didn't have anything. And then the final kind of piece to their puzzle was the bug evidence, which I'd never heard of before in my life. Like, I'd never, I guess I assumed that there are different types of bugs in different parts of the country, because there's, you know, different climates and things like that.
Yeah.
But to use it in a murder case is something that is very, you know, different. And they actually, you know, it's one of those cases that I think the use of the bug evidence is so, you know, out of the ordinary or extraordinary that this case was profiled on the reboot of Forensic Files.
Okay.
Because they focus, you know, on the bug evidence.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I can see that, because like certain plants grow in certain places.
Exactly.
Even how, you know, how Bella go and she go to Florida and bring different plants and trees.
And we know that there's different bugs in different parts of the world. Right. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen the videos of stuff that's going on in like Australia, like the stuff that they, the type of bugs that they have in Australia, you'd be like, Lord, I don't even want to go there.
Right.
Like, you know, like giant spiders and, you know, so like there's, you know, and it's because of, like I said, different climates, different areas, different bugs. But like I said, to use them as part of a murder case as something that's just like, you know, people are like, that sounds crazy. But when you think about it, it doesn't, because of that fact, because there are different bugs in different parts of the country. So if he rents a car in Ohio and that car had stayed in Ohio, then, you know, that's what the radiator would have, you know, the bugs on the radiator would have represented that, right?
I still think it's crazy, but
it is crazy.
I mean, I understand the logic.
Yeah,
of course
exactly.
It is crazy. Like,
and here's the thing. When you look at a case like this, I think it is that maybe if that evidence was standing alone, it would be like,
it's coupled with something else.
Yeah, you can't convict him because he had a bug from California and the radiator. Like,
right.
But you can if you couple that with all the other evidence.
Right.
And that's the issue for Vincent Brothers, is that if any one of these things had stood alone, maybe it would have been harder for the prosecution to build a case on it. Had it just been the credit cards, had it just been the odometer, had it just been the bugs in the radiator, it might have been harder for them to build a fuller picture.
Right.
But the fact that all of these things happened in this period of time, all around the time that his family is coincidentally murdered, that's very hard to explain for him as the defendant, as the accused in this case. And that's clear by the fact that a jury did not believe him. And I thought that it was interesting, even with the testimony of the rental car agency representative who said, you know, sometimes the odometer readings are not accurate. I think that is, even for a juror, I would say, okay, I can see it. But I can see it being not accurate by like a few miles. I can't see it not being accurate by thousands of miles. That seems crazy. I can see it all being put in, you know, okay, it was, 294 miles, but I put in 298. Okay, that makes, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
or like
it makes a little
something
more sense.
Reasonable. You're talking about there's was a incorrect for thousands of miles, 3,000 miles, whatever. That to me, and I think that's probably why, even with that testimony being presented and that argument trying to be made by the defense,
okay,
that the jury still convicted him and was just like, that's not adding up. That's just not adding up. And despite him being this, this principal, this school administrator, you know, also the fact that he did have this history of being violent with his other wives, I think the fact that he had been married multiple times, you know, the prosecution was able to paint this picture of him being a womanizer, being a cheater, and for whatever reason, deciding that he just didn't want to be a husband and a father and murdering everybody.
Yeah, that's terrible. Well, Vincent Brothers, May 15, 2007, was found guilty.
Yes.
On all five counts of murder and sentenced to death. He remains housed at San Quentin State Prison. And
you know who else is in San Quentin? Scott Peterson, Lacey Peterson.
Oh wow.
Murderer.
Oh wow, yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's that, well, you know, when the that's where they send the murderers in California.
Yeah. San Quentin.
I'm sure there's a lot of family annihilators in San Quentin, man. Sadly. But yeah.
So, as we go to our questions and comments, I didn't see a lot of questions, only because people listened.
And y'all didn't know understand we was going to do afterthoughts.
They know what happened.
Yeah.
But just a few comments, and we thank you for your comments. Like I said in the beginning, this is for you guys to also tap in to the conversation. Ask your questions, be a part of the Black Rogue One community. And, you know, sometimes dig a little deeper. You dig a little deeper, never know what you find. And every question counts. And I'll go to the first question. It's on YouTube. And it says, not the first question, the first comment. The fact that he was selling his things.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about this, but when they found him, he was selling, you know, a lot of the stuff because he was trying to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, the fact that he was selling his things, perhaps trying to leave America to another continent.
Mm-hmm.
God is great. The spirit of his family wouldn't allow it to happen. And they go on with another few words. But that, you mentioned the signs of you know, him being guilty.
Yeah, definitely.
And that was one of the signs of,
everything
him
is
trying
not
to get out of there.
Everything's not a coincidence. You know what I mean? Like, it can't be. And it's not a conspiracy against him. You know what I mean? Like, the facts are the facts. And what happened. And it's obvious because the prosecution presented this case in front of 12 people and they found him guilty. They saw the evidence. They saw the excuses. They saw the counter argument from the defense, and it didn't matter. Everything, when you look at it you know, as a whole, you know, if it looks like a duck, you know.
Yeah, man.
It's a duck. It's a duck.
Yeah. The next comment I want to go to is on YouTube once again. And it says, I remember this case and how they said he wouldn't have to drive extremely fast and stop the whole way for the timing of the murders.
Mm-hmm.
That part made me skeptical.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, and that was part of the defense's argument, was that it was not possible for him to drive. It's possible for him to drive the distance, but not in the time in which it would have been, you know, it would have taken him. Like, he would have basically had to drive nonstop to California, come back, and, you know, I mean, kill his family and then do the same thing coming back. But like I said, these arguments, that's the thing about, like, the trial, right? It's because these arguments are presented at trial. If his defense attorney did his job, and from what I've saw about the trial, he presented this evidence, he presented these facts at trial, and it still, you know what I mean? Like, it still it didn't matter. And I don't have all of that evidence. I wasn't a juror. I don't know what they saw. I don't know what they were given by the prosecution. I don't know how this evidence was, like I said, presented to them. But clearly, it wasn't what the defense brought to the table, wasn't enough to even create one juror who said, yeah, you know what?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That sounds a little fishy, because then it would have ended in a mistrial, but it didn't. It ended up in conviction and then a death sentence. So I'm going to lean towards whatever they saw was, you know, told them that this man was guilty. So, and that's it. Like,
yeah, man. That's really the sentiments also on Instagram. So,
yeah.
I'm glad we were able to have this conversation, this Afterthoughts. We are back with Afterthoughts. And anything you want to end with, Short?
No, just we're happy to be back. I'm glad that you guys, you know, for those, like you said, those of you who listen to Afterthoughts and like Afterthoughts, sorry for the break, but we'll be, you know, we're back. And like Jason said, we're going to try to, you know, make sure that we're doing, you know, Afterthoughts about shows that you want to hear, you know.
Definitely.
What I mean? Stories that need afterthoughts, you know, every story doesn't need an afterthought. I think some stories you guys do want to know what, you know, what I think, what we think. And so we're definitely going to continue on with Afterthoughts. But I appreciate everybody who asked and who's, you know, commented and said, where's Afterthoughts? I miss Afterthoughts.
We're going to continue to build it.
We know it's not for everybody. We know everybody is not, you know, like you said, somebody said, I don't get it. I know, you know, it's okay. It's all right. My feelings are not hurt. But for those of you who do get it and do enjoy it, thank you for listening and thank you for supporting us. And, you know, we'll be back with another Afterthoughts. Thank you guys so much. And we will, of course, be back on Monday with a brand new Black Girl Gone. So